All right, everybody, welcome to the Most Basic Cable. It's kind of a, you know, special presentation by me and Chris. We're kind of taking a turn away from sports on this one, and we are going to be focusing on the HBO series The Jinx. So if I don't know if everyone's caught up. If you aren't, spoilers.
Yeah, just go ahead and
turn it off right now. this was something that Jinx, I got into probably when the third episode aired. My roommate's boyfriend watches it a lot, and he had kind of told us about it. He came in and was like freaking out one day about how great it was, and he said it was a lot like Serial, and so I kind of wanted to dig in. So for those of you who don't know, maybe a little backstory. The Jinx is a documentary series, a 6-part documentary series, about Robert Durst, who's a real estate, heir, multimillionaire.
Yeah. His family is one of the top property owners in Manhattan.
Yeah. A lot of Times Square properties, yeah. Things like that. Who was involved. He's always been very eccentric. Was involved, not involved, you know, his wife had disappeared in the 70s, and there was an investigation into it. Nothing really ever came from it. Interestingly enough, a guy named Andrew Jarecki directed a film called All Good Things, which I had seen when it came out. It came out a couple of years ago. It's Ryan Gosling plays Durst. And I'm blanking on the
Kirsten Dunst
plays his wife. And I've got to be honest, hated that movie. And so that's why, like, when I'd heard that was what it was about, I didn't want to see it. And so the hype started building.
Yeah, it's a strange thing with the story in that it was a very New York story.
Yeah.
It was featured on SNL.
Yep.
In the news. And it was a story that anybody paying attention to media in 2000, when one of Durst's alleged murders—well, the story in with the man he killed in Texas,
yes,
kind of kicked all of this off again.
Yeah,
and it flared up, but enough time had passed, it seemed, where it went away, and it really wasn't part of the culture anymore.
The narrative of what was happening.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, and we'll get into it, but that's the thing about Robert Durst and who he is and what's happened is time continually appears to be on his side.
Yes.
Time passes, people forget, and that's really what I took
away. Keeps on
doing Robert Durst things. So we'll kind of give you some background. So first and foremost, how this series started, Jarecki had done All Good Things. Durst had reached out to Jarecki to talk to him. This is modern day. And, you know, Jarecki kind of discussed, you know, maybe doing a documentary series. And Durst, as he is an innocent person,
agreed. He wanted to tell his side of the story.
Yeah.
And he wanted to tell it weirdly.
Yeah. Well, which he does everything weirdly.
Yeah. And it really got into this fascinating tale of murder and the documentary starts with a body found in Texas.
Yep.
Chopped to bits.
Yep.
Head missing. And evidence points to Robert Durst.
Yep.
And he's arrested and post bail and then just vanishes,
of course, because that's what he does
for a long period of time.
Yep.
He's gone. He is then apprehended in a Wegmans,
yeah,
which is my favorite grocery store. Wegmans, if you're listening, we need you in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Yeah, I don't even know where the closest Wegmans are.
Yeah, Pennsylvania or something. They are great. I'll take you someday. But he was apprehended at a Wegmans stealing a $6 sandwich.
Yeah.
When he had $900 cash on him and thousands of dollars cash in his car.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, same thing, like when, and we'll kind of go through the timeline, but when he was arrested, for the Morris Black, murder or suspicion of murder, you know, they said the bail was like $500,000 or something.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, and they're like, do you have, you know, do you have that bail? And he's like, well, not on me. Yeah, but I can get it. let's kind of go through the timeline of Robert Durst and we'll kind of set this up. So his wife disappears in the 80s, right? Early 80s. They kind of had a tumultuous relationship. I think that what they hit on in the series are her friends and her family were really unsettled by who he was. I think there was the intent from her to leave him. And the way the story goes is, she's at a friend's house. She gets home. She's deciding she wants to go stay in the city. She's a med student. She wants to go stay in the city 'cause she has school. And so he sees her off at the train station. Nobody ever sees her again. Period. Because nobody still has ever seen her again. Nothing
30
is,
years now.
Nothing has turned up. And then early 2000s is the next. Is the Morris Black murder. And the Morris Black murder, it's really what kicks off this story. And it's the cop that is talking so vividly about something floating in a bay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like he reaches into a torso and pulls it out of the water. And you're just like, that's like 10 minutes into the series.
If 10 minutes, it's quite a hook.
Yeah.
I've devoured a lot of true crime stories and the body found moment is usually the impetus for the whole story. And Jarecki played it really well. He does these interesting dramatizations of these scenes.
Yeah, he does, which I find fascinating.
Which is, the thing I really liked about them is you never see anybody's face in these dramatizations.
Right.
Like they're always from behind. They're always a point of view shot, which sometimes they were a little indulgent, but pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think, effective way to tell the story. So the Morris Black killing happens. And that's, Durst is arrested and then he flees and then he's found in Pennsylvania and brought back to Texas for that trial. Meanwhile, back in New York, a district attorney, Jeanine Pirro, who has an incredible face.
Unbelievable. The brows.
Yeah. In our previous episode, we talked a little bit about Mark Few's face being pulled tighter, but her face was just like enhance.
I remember my girlfriend's watching it and we're watching it together and she goes, that's just the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. It's prosecutor.
Starts looking into his wife's disappearance again. Her old friends want them to get in contact with this woman in California. And before they can get in contact with her, she's found dead.
Yeah.
And
perfect timing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, shot in the back of the head, sort of execution style. Her family had some ties to the mob.
Yep.
And one of the alarming things, and it becomes a crucial piece of evidence in the series, is her body probably wouldn't have been found if the Beverly Hills police had not received a note that with her address on it and the word cadaver. So it became known as the cadaver note.
Yep.
And that's really when I was watching the series initially, I was like, man, they're spending a lot of time on this note. What are they setting up with this note? It was block printing on the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly Hills was spelled wrong.
Yep.
with an E after the L. And they just really spent a lot of time on this note and end up becoming kind of the smoking gun for all of this stuff and a pretty dramatic thing. So this woman's found dead. A lot of Durst's wife, Kathy's friends, think that she may have been the one who knew something about something. She was protective of Durst.
She was his PR rep.
Yeah.
When everything was going on. With his wife, and they were close friends. They had gone to college together, and she was the daughter of a mobster, and was well off growing up, and he was the son of a real estate mogul, and was rich growing up, and I think they had bonded together, and I think he confided his deepest, darkest secrets in her because as much of a nutball as he is, because he's kind of like a goofy, he's not as he's dark. Definitely there are some dark edges, but he's also like, he's kind of like your weird old uncle, you know? And he had confided in her his secrets, which I'm sure he had a hard time keeping in. And I think that people just got too close.
Yeah, I think one thing that, to make sure we're clear on the timeline, the murder of Susan Berman. Yeah, Susan Berman's having a hard time with her name. Actually happened before Morris Black's murder.
That's right.
Yeah. Something interesting. So there was this thought that Durst got wind of Jeanine Pirro reopening the case into his wife's disappearance. And because of that, Susan Berman was the only loose end and needed to be silenced.
And that's why he had gone. That's why he had fled.
Yeah.
Right. Because when the Morris Black murder happened, and this is really what's tying together for me, is he is dressing up as a woman.
Yeah. He was already living like a fugitive.
Yeah. He was living in Texas, Galveston.
Yes.
And he is, he is portraying a mute older woman. He's dressing up as a woman. He rents out this apartment.
His explanation about why he dresses a woman is perfect. And he's like, because nobody would recognize me.
Exactly.
It's the perfect disguise.
Yeah. In fact, it is, Robert. Yeah. And he rents a lower flat next to, it's kind of like a duplex situation next to Morris Black's flat. And
something interesting about that, like, I am by no way, shape, or form a man of great means.
Right.
If I were on the run, I would shudder to live in the state he was living in.
Yeah, like, why would you live in Texas?
Shitty apartment.
Yeah.
In Texas.
Yeah.
Smoking weed.
And drinking
cheap whiskey.
Yeah.
Like you got a little money. Like,
yeah,
you know,
do something.
Right.
Yeah. Or go abroad.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I never understood. Just go to a country where you can't be touched. But I think why he didn't do that. Well, one, I think inherently there's something about him where he always wanted to get caught. And I think that's why he allowed Jarecki to do this.
He does seem to have, he wants to play on the edge.
Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, and this is a thing of a guy who grew up with everything and kind of probably was always given everything. And, you know, I think he felt like it was his one thing he could do in this world, as weird as that is. Mm-hmm. He's living in this like very, just downtrodden type of environment. And it's crazy because the police, so after him and Morris Black, there's an altercation, a gun is fired, Morris Black is dead. His thought process, because he's a sane person, is I'm just going to dismember this person.
Yeah, I have to get rid of this person because I'm already implicated in a murder.
Right.
You know,
and I'm probably on the flee from another murder.
Right.
And so he, in a maniacal manner, which the defense explains, the defense attorney explains, he cuts up Morris Black and puts him in garbage bags. And the only reason they got back to him is because there was, I think it was like an envelope with his address on it.
In one of the garbage bags. It was a receipt for an optometrist. Like,
that's
for
right.
Glasses. Yeah.
That's right. To go pick up glasses.
Yeah.
And the crack team of detectives were like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
So
Cody's mustache figured that out.
Cody, I don't know your last name.
Cazales,
maybe. That dude.
He looks like a detective.
He looks like a Texas detective.
Yeah, he was great. I love Cody.
Great band name, Texas Detective.
He dismembers the body.
He dismembers the body.
Puts it in a bunch of bags, takes it to a dock.
A bay.
And just starts throwing them in the water.
Yeah, he's like, here we go.
And like, he's thinking to himself, like, this is a great plan.
Well, isn't it? Doesn't everybody know that dead bodies float?
I know that I float. I mean, I'm alive, but...
Well, isn't there always a sense of like, you know, we got a floater in the bay or something like that,
exactly,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you read a detective novel, when bodies are found in water, they're not found at the bottom, but they're found, you know, found at the top.
Right.
So
he freaks out, though.
He freaks out.
Yeah.
And he leaves everything behind.
Yeah.
but the head.
Yeah.
And they even kind of talk about this in the trial.
Yeah.
And this is really the big moment, because if they find the head and they find that Morris Black was shot in the back of the head,
yep,
then it's Which is probably a whole different deal.
MO.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this, right? He gets it's the most insane part, because so he's arrested under suspicion of the Morris Black trial, then tried with, for murder. And then he's clearly, very well off. And he's like, well, I want this one lawyer mm-hmm. to represent me. And his wife, who's another insane person.
Yeah, she's, I would have liked to have seen more of her.
So would I.
Yeah.
I don't think they could get her.
Yeah.
She wants another lawyer, mm-hmm. a defense lawyer. And so, of course, they hire both of the
Why
lawyers.
Why not? Yeah,
Yeah. And the guys, I've got to say, they did an amazing job.
Yeah, the prosecution blundered by turning it into a – he did, like, the sick way he dismembered this body. Like, they just opened the door for – he's not on trial because he cut up a body. Like, sure, that's something that a man in duress decided to do, and it wasn't a great decision. But it's not the crime he's being tried
right, and
for.
His and what he explained was, they had an altercation, and
they Morris, really, I mean, they really put Morris Black on trial.
Yeah, Morris Black pulled a gun, and then Durst, grabbed the gun, and then they both fell on the ground, and it went off.
Yeah.
If you just look at it at just the basic information, you're like, clearly this guy is guilty. But what else is interesting is when the defense attorneys were talking to Durst and they were asking him about the dismemberment, they said that he explained it in such incredible detail that they said, if you say it like this on the stand, they're going to know that you did this maliciously. And so when he was on the stand, he did a magnificent job on the stand himself. And they go, well, do you remember what happened when you dismembered the body? And he's like, no, I don't really remember. So that's what they told him to do. And it wasn't just that I thought was fascinating. It's the fact that he made the jury laugh when he was on the stand, which was really disturbing. And I don't know if it's because he was in Texas or if,
I do think there's a part of the documentary that we didn't get to see. Is that I went into the documentary thinking, oh, this guy's a weirdo.
Yeah.
I'm going to think that he's guilty of these things.
Yep.
And because of that, I think that I was immune or blind to the charm that even Andrew Jarecki, the director, seems to be under. And you never really get to see it. And except for in that one moment where here's a guy who's on trial for murder.
Yeah.
And he makes the jury chuckle.
Yeah.
And he does it in a way, it's not like he tells a great joke.
No.
He's just kind of weird.
That's who he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says things in such a matter of fact manner
mm-hmm.
that he just, I think he just always thinks he's right and he thinks you're in the wrong. And, when he made them chuckle is when the two prosecutors are standing up and mimicking Durst and Morris Black struggling mm-hmm. and they're like, well, is this what it looked like? And he goes, oh, you guys look like spaghetti to me right now. Mm-hmm. And like, I was like, that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
So lo and behold,
not guilty. Yeah. So he's a free dude
again.
He's just out there
just doing
for whatever, for how many
just
years
stealing subs and being crazy.
So, and then like the story dies and the movie comes out.
Yep.
And he agrees to do this, and it all kicks up again.
Yeah,
starts telling this story. So as I was watching it, it kind of got to the point where you're like, well, what's the story
here? Yes, agreed. I was in the same spot.
We talked, and then it shifts back to Susan Berman, and the timeline that Jarecki tells the story on is kind of jumbled.
Yes,
but it is effective in that it builds suspense, and it kind of. It takes this, everything sort of points to this piece at the end.
Yep.
So when they revisit the Susan Berman case, we meet a man who has a strange name, who was the son of a man who was dating Susan Berman for a while.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think they were married.
Oh.
they were married. Susan Berman was married to his father and his sister. Their dad married her, if I'm not mistaken. And then when they got divorced, they asked to stay with Susan.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that was her son, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And again, his not only strange name, strange facial hair, strange everything.
Yeah.
He's like, he is a strange bird, but he seemed like a very honest person. And so Jarecki kind of finds out, they kind of dig into the backstory about how their kids and Susan raises them and how Robert is a big part of their life because he's a big part of Susan's life and he would help out Susan financially. And after, you know, Susan was murdered, Robert was kind of a parental figure to him, you know, to both of the kids.
Yeah. I mean, he provided the son with $100,000 to go to school.
Yep.
And, you know, and there's a really chilling moment. I think it's at the end of the fourth episode where that, the son is telling the story and he goes, you know, I'd like some closure on this because if it's just a random murder,
yeah,
that's not good.
But, right.
But, you know, then it just is what it is. Yep. But if it's not a random murder, then it's probably somebody that I know.
Yep.
And they kind of leave it hanging at that moment there. And then the fifth episode builds and builds and they talk about Durst's family and the weirdness behind that.
Yes.
And it all leads back to Los Angeles and yep. Susan Berman when this guy finds a letter that he had sent to Susan that Robert Durst had sent to Susan.
Yep.
And on the letter, the address of on the envelope, the smoking gun is that Beverly is spelled
incorrectly
in a very similar block print.
Like incredibly similar. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, unbelievably similar. You see it and the kid had found it.
Yeah.
Going through Susan's things and he called Jarecki.
Visibly shaken.
Yeah. Visibly shaken. Like, yeah.
And understandably yeah, so because
this is a person who's been very close to you for a very long time who killed your, you know, stepmother. And who you still are close with,
yeah.
Who he had seen very recently before that, and called Jarecki and was visibly shaken, and they see it, and we as an audience see it, and we're like, oh my God, like this is crazy. And that's where it starts leveling up.
Yeah.
Like, that's where it really starts picking up.
Yeah, and that's this, I mean, for all intents and purposes, that's the end of the documentary.
Yes.
And then it shifts into this whole weird, like, I don't want to say journalistic.
Yeah.
But it at this point, there's a shift in the story, and the story is no longer about what happened.
And what's happening.
It's what's happening now. Yep. And it's Jarecki trying to get in touch with Durst. They have a plan to reveal this information to him in a way that, I mean, they are... And they have conversations about whether it's cold to do it this way.
Yeah.
If they're going to blindside him with it.
And if he's going to, not only if it's cold, but are they going to spook him?
Yeah.
That, to me, that was a big concern of Jarecki.
Mm-hmm.
Is they're all positioning themselves in the room, you know, and kind of going through it and talking the way they're going to talk. And let's present it like this. Let's present this. Let's present the first, you know, let's present the cadaver note. You know, and then let's present the letter sent to Susan. And then Jarecki, you got to give Jarecki a lot of credit because it's just him. And he's dealing with a guy who's unstable.
Yeah.
A guy who, like, whose brother, who now runs his father's company, has a restraining order against him. You know, he got...
And that's the lead up to this confrontation that the story ends with is... It's so strange because there's almost this sense that Durst is aware of something like his spidey sense is tingling enough because he's ducking Jarecki for the first time. He doesn't want attention. And he doesn't want to participate anymore.
Yep.
And then he gets caught going to his brother's apartment.
Yep. Walking up to the steps,
which he can't, you know, he's got a restraining order. He can't get there. So he's arrested for that.
Yep.
And again, it's just like stealing the sub.
Mm-hmm.
Like he just can't seem to help himself. And so part of this, and almost it felt like there was a deal, but maybe not a deal made where because he was arrested, Durst's defense wanted
the video
footage that Jarecki had of them walking around the city and doing all this to kind of prove that, like, you know, he knew what it was, but maybe Chet said, you know, like, kind of take some of the edge off of what he was doing there.
Right.
And it seemed like because that happened, then, you know, Jarecki would do something for Durst. It was never implicitly stated that
the
case.
Yeah, I think he had said at one point, I will gladly hand over any footage I have and audio I have if you're willing to sit down.
Yeah.
I think there was a conversation. I don't know if that conversation was with Durst. I believe it was probably with his legal counsel. But once that was done, he sat down again.
Yeah.
You know?
And then that's when shit got real.
That's when it got real. Yeah. Yeah, that's when it was, like, kind of terrifying.
And really, if you're still listening and you haven't seen this,
Stop
right now. I don't want
because we still haven't the best part of it is still not ruined.
Yeah. And yes, exactly. And I was watching this. My wife was sort of watching it along with me. She went out with a friend and I finished it. She's like, go ahead and finish it. And she came home and I was like, all right, you're going to watch the last 10 minutes. I brought her up to speed. And I was like, just watch this.
Yeah.
So they set up the interview.
Yep.
And they're going through everything. And there's actually kind of like a weirdly tender moment when you consider what the audience knows at this point and what Jarecki knows.
Yes.
Where he brings this picture of Durst and Berman.
Yep.
And at this point, in the viewer's eyes, in Jarecki's eyes, it's like a done deal that Durst killed this woman.
Yeah.
The leap to him not doing it is far greater than the leap to him doing it.
Correct.
And there's this picture of them and Durst, like, cool as a cucumber, asks for a copy.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Can I have a copy? And Drecky's like, you can have this one.
Yeah.
Like, as a gift.
Yeah.
And then they get to it and it's I do admire the way that Drecky talked about it.
Yes.
Because his heart had to be hammering.
Oh yeah. Well, you're sitting across from a guy that you know has killed at least, that you can assume has killed at least three people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people who were close to him and people he had spent time with.
Yeah.
And you could be one of those people.
And people who got in his way.
Yeah.
For whatever, like, you know, found something out about him they didn't like.
Yeah.
You know.
That's the one thing about it that I just don't know that everyone understood fully. If he's leaves and he's walking around the street, you know, and he puts it together, there's no doubt in my mind he goes after Jarecki.
Yeah.
So yeah, Jarecki's heart has to be pounding. And at this point, this is when he starts delivering the information.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, he reveals the letter first. And he talks about it and Durst makes the notice that the Beverly is spelled wrong.
First thing he says.
Yeah. Beverly is spelled wrong.
Yep.
And I believe at this moment Durst has to believe that he's trapped or he knows something is coming.
Yeah.
And then they bring the cadaver note and the misspelling there. And the reaction that Durst has, like, he physically is so interesting. He belches, but like, it's not like a belch. It's like an exorcism.
It is.
It's just like something bubbling up out of him.
Yeah.
That is,
it's something he can no longer contain.
Yeah.
It's something he's been holding back forever.
Mm-hmm.
That in every day, in every moment of his life, he must put so much energy into keeping everything secret.
Yeah.
And it's something that is finally coming to the surface.
Mm-hmm. And Jarecki doesn't pounce on him.
No.
He shows him a comparison of the two Beverly Hills from the letter and from the note.
Yep.
And asks Durst. And Durst denies writing the note.
Yeah.
In that moment. But then he asks Durst to pick out which one he didn't write.
Yeah.
And he can't do it.
Yep.
And then they move on.
Yeah.
And it's just...
And let me say, too, before we get any further, when they first talked about the cadaver note in the first interview prior to that, Durst said, whoever wrote that note killed Susan Berman.
Mm-hmm.
Flat out.
Yeah.
And that was going through my mind at this moment. And it must have been going through his mind that he had said that. It had to be going through his mind that he was trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And they you're right. They move on and they say, hey, Bob, thanks for
everything. Yeah. We'll be in touch when this is over. Yeah. And they go their way. And then if that weren't enough,
right,
for the second time, it happens earlier.
Yeah.
In the first interview with Durst, he's talking and
they take a break. Yeah, in the first interview, they take a break.
And he's got a live mic.
And he's talking about the trial,
mm-hmm.
The Morris Black trial. And he's saying the whole truth, the truth, but not the whole truth.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. Tell the truth, but don't tell the whole truth. Mm-hmm. Tell the truth, but don't tell. Yeah, and he's saying it over and over and over.
Pumping himself up.
Yeah. He has been coached and coached and coached and coached, right? Whether it was his lawyers in Texas or the guy who steps into the scene at that moment, they go, it's his lawyer.
Yeah.
And it says, Bob, they
can hear you.
They can hear you. Your mic's on.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh,
yeah.
Okay. And then he stops.
And he stops.
So now, for the second time, they kill the lights. Mm-hmm. You know, he's looking for a bathroom.
Finds a bathroom. And then starts talking.
Yeah.
And talking to himself. Almost like a very, like, it's conversational.
Well, but he's questioning things.
Yes.
So, I don't know what's at the house.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Of course. I killed them.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the hammering blow is the last thing he says. Of course I killed them. What the hell have I done?
Yeah.
Of course I killed them all.
Yeah.
Or killed them all, of course, is what he says. And then it fades to black.
Yeah.
But in that speech, I'd like the I killed them all thing is the kind of the damning thing. But the terrifying line was he says something and I almost feel like he's talking to Jarecki.
Yeah.
And he says, you were right.
Yeah.
I was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't imagine.
That's the terrifying thing.
And that's like,
what else is out there?
The line at the house, but it's very chilling.
Yeah.
After the trial
or
after that interview, it airs. He's actually arrested the day before it aired.
Yeah.
In New Orleans,
which I had no idea. So, my girlfriend, we had been watching it together. And I had said on our last podcast, I went and celebrated St. Patrick's Day a little too hard. And that was the night of the final episode. And I slept through it. And she didn't want to watch it without me. And she goes to work the next day. And it was the weekend. And so, like, she really hadn't noticed anything in the news. And then she starts seeing all these stories about Robert Durst. And she immediately quits looking.
Yeah.
And then she comes home from work. And I come home. And she's like, we have to watch the last episode. She's like, we just have to watch it. And so we're watching it. And all that happens. And the moment you're talking about, you know, where you're saying you can't imagine, she grabs my hand. And she's just like, this is unreal. And then it's over. And then she immediately grabs my laptop. And she's like, look.
Yeah.
He was arrested yesterday.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is insane.
And it's not really clear when that interview happened.
Jarecki, I did a little research.
Okay.
Jarecki had the information for a couple of months.
Okay.
He had gone to authorities. They didn't pounce on Durst right away. I know that he said he had hoped it would be sooner rather than later. Clearly, he's worried about his own health and safety.
Mm-hmm.
But they were keeping tabs on Durst and knew where he was at. And so the police were informing him so he felt safe.
Okay.
And then it just all went down to New Orleans.
Yeah. And when they found him, he had found like a latex mask and a bunch of cash and guns. And
yeah.
And they found him on the day that the first flight from the United States to Cuba
was
like in 50 years.
Yep.
That was the day they got him. So,
he was clearly on the move.
Yeah.
He was clearly finally doing the thing that he probably should have done all along, which was flee the country.
Yeah. And that's like, was he watching this show?
Yeah, he had
like,
to be.
Yeah.
Had to be watching
the
show.
And what do you think his relationship with the show was when he was watching it? Was he like,
probably.
And then at the end of the fifth episode, he's like,
oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's.
But he knew that. Like, he knew that Jarecki had that.
Well, he didn't know that, but he didn't.
But he didn't know about not the recording.
He didn't know about the audio.
He did know about the letter. And
but is that enough?
Right.
Clearly it had spooked him.
Yeah.
Right? But when he got arrested in Texas, he probably had the same thought process.
Yeah.
This is it. You know, God only, you know, if they only know mm-hmm. what else is out there. Now, this is the thing where I wonder, you know, do I have faith in our justice system? Where he gets tried, I would assume California. Mm-hmm. This is the thing. Now that he's got the same lawyers he had before, you can't pull the same stunt you did before.
Right.
Right. Jarecki did an amazing job of tracking. He had flown into Northern California and driven down, rented a car, driven down to Beverly Hills to kill Susan Berman. And he kind of disputes it originally. You know, he said, that's a long drive. It's hard for someone to make that drive, says someone who's made that drive.
Yeah.
And now I'm so intrigued by the trial because not only is it, will he finally be prosecuted and will he finally be found guilty for something he's done, but will he divulge other information?
Yeah. What happens when that happens?
Where's your wife? Where's Morris Black's head? Mm-hmm. Where is this stuff? Like that, where, you know, I mean, they hit on it at one point, Susan Berman's dad, who was, you know, again, a mobster of some sort. There were some woods
in Jersey
where apparently there were a lot of, you know, people had gone missing. But that's my biggest thing now is I want to know. And are there other people? Do you think he's only killed, you know?
He seemed pretty good at it.
Yeah. Seems great. Yeah. Latex mask and a bag of cash and guns.
Yeah.
Was he going to shoot his way into Cuba? Like, you know, so, you know, he's a terrifying serial killer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was heavy. It was the heaviest thing I've watched. And this is the culture we're in now, which is amazing because we talk about Serial.
Yeah. It's,
you know,
the,
though this was better than Serial.
Yeah. Well, it's a different kind of story.
Yeah.
And that's the weird relationship that I've always had with true crime.
Yeah.
In that it's always been something like kind of dirty.
Did you feel like an outlier?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I've been reading this weird stuff for years and trying to make sense of why I like it because, you know, we've made some jokes about this topic, but like, these are real people who got killed by a real dude.
Yeah.
It's not a detective novel. It's not like, you know, an episode of whatever.
Right.
This is NCIS.
Yeah. Yeah.
Baton Rouge.
Like, what's the Vanderbeek show?
And CSI Cyber.
I remember cybering in the 90s.
Yeah.
Never of James Vanderbeek. Yeah. So
not that you know of.
I don't want your life.
So that's the thing that I'm excited about is that now with Serial and with this, like Earl Morris, who's kind of famous for making The Thin Blue Line, which is a documentary a lot like this with dramatizations that ended up getting an innocent man who had been convicted of a crime released.
Yeah.
Now I wonder as a culture if our craving for these kinds of stories is elevated because of the conversations that we have around them. In the past, you know, if you think of like the great true crime stories, the Manson family murders, O.J. Simpson is probably the most famous, most nationally. The one we didn't have these like artful looks at these stories where somebody was distilling them down as entertainment.
Right. And we also didn't have the response system that we have now.
Correct.
In the sense of like, there wasn't Twitter, you know, like there wasn't, I'm amazed that I made it 2 days without finding out about that.
Yeah. I made it a week.
Yeah. And I told you I said radio silence.
And like, yes, if I saw the word Durst.
Yeah. You're just looking away.
Yeah. Just
closing, unless there's a Fred in front of it.
And then still looking away. I do. Did you know that in one, some outlet somewhere out there, they referred to Robert Durst as Fred Durst and posted a photo of him, like former Limp Bizkit frontman arrested for murder of
fact-checking is not their strong suit.
Yeah. It's, you know,
shut up, man.
But,
So, I mean, it's, you know, true crime it's definitely a huge genre right now. And I am fascinated again. I can't express this enough. I think that All Good Things is a pretty terrible movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's not very good. It's not very well done. It's just weird. And, but, you know, the case subject was weird, you know, and I think Ryan Gosling was weird in that movie. But this is so well done. And maybe it's because everything was on the line, including, like, his own health and safety. But, like, this was an amazing piece of work by Andrew Jarecki.
Yeah, I was impressed by the documentary. I did, some of it was indulgent.
Yeah.
You know, I understand why he inserted himself into the story at the end.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it so much to
earlier
that point.
On. Yeah.
I thought it was a little distracting. Mostly it was the sideburns, which I think had like EP credits, both of them, lefty and righty.
The Jarecki facial hair.
But, you know, he caught a story that I don't know that he was expecting to catch.
No.
And
I think he was just, going with it. I think he's like, there might be something here, you know, maybe, you know, I'm coming and I'll be honest. Maybe it's because that film didn't do well that he's like, I'll take this.
Yeah. This is a redemption.
Yeah. Let's
see. I mean,
this.
He may have was looking for redemption on the story. I think Robert Durst was looking for,
he wanted to, cause that movie points towards him being responsible for that.
Yeah.
And he wanted to speak his case.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I think, I mean, if I'm thinking about it, I think what Robert Durst wanted was, I think he wanted everybody to think that he was guilty.
Yeah.
But not be able to do anything about it.
Really?
I do.
Well, he's the craziest person ever.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
aren't there aspects though where he knows loose ends are untied, right?
Yeah, but.
He sent a letter. Like, what kind of a maniac that kind of goes back to my point though. The guy, he's right. Like you said, he's right on that edge.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to play as close to that edge as possible. And this was it.
Yeah.
Like this was his swan song, so to speak.
And that's like the recurring thing in all these true crime stories. And one of my favorite things about him is, the small inconsistencies that lead to the downfalls of these like criminal, I don't want to say criminal mastermind,
right.
but clearly for 30 plus years, he was really good at getting away with murder.
Yep.
And it was all undone by a silly spelling mistake.
Yeah.
And you know, a letter that was sent at one time, he probably sent that letter to Susan Berman, and maybe at that point he didn't realize he'd ever have to kill her.
Well, he was sending her money then.
Yeah.
So I doubt he did.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really fascinating to me just the gall with which he goes about life, and just like it's really amazing to me that, you know, you bring up a valid point. Like, he was able to evade being caught forever. He was able to spin his way out of those things forever. But when I go back and I'm watching it the entire time, I'm just like, this guy's the most guilty person I am. Until the court scene, until he was in the court scene and he made the jury kind of chuckle and he kind of made me chuckle, up until then, I'm like, why is this guy walking around?
Right.
Like, what,
how did this happen?
How is this happening? And then that's when it kind of pieced together for me. It's like, he's really good at being weirdly charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's one point in the first interview, his eyes are so dilated, like it looks like his eyes are pitch black.
Yeah,
like he's just
like a terrifying lizard.
I have to say, my favorite, your favorite comedic part of it is Jarecki's facial hair. My favorite comedic part of it, because there's always comedy and everything, is his prison photos.
Yeah.
he's like on the ground with his fingers up in the air, or he's got his hands on the shoulders of two gigantic men in prison.
Yeah.
His crew. Well, he's going to have that again for a while now. So
I certainly hope so. It'll definitely, I mean, he's joined the pantheon of American monsters.
Yeah.
And for a lot of those guys that are in that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of demons out there and people that were, as a culture, I think we're afraid of.
Yeah.
I think this is the closest we've come to like one of them talking to us, like having a relationship.
Having a relationship with a monster. Yeah. What do you think though? And I wonder about this as well. You talked about journalism, where it goes from a documentary to a journalism piece. Mm-hmm. I do think, because my statement to my girlfriend after it was over was, it's really fascinating that journalism actually kind of in my lifetime has come through to put somebody away.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really seen it to that level, you know, to like, it's not Woodward and Bernstein, but to that, you know, it's a big thing. It's a monumental piece of information that they found, yeah, that they sought out, that other people weren't looking for or weren't good enough to find. So I do think they, Jarecki and his crew, deserve credit for being journalists when it got to that point. And I think that, you know, I hope that the American public, or, you know, that maybe our generation as a whole puts a little bit more thought after seeing that into the American justice system and into journalism and into what you can do and what you can affect, and what you have the ability to do. So I was really inspired by what Jarecki did. I thought it was really fascinating. And again, it seems to be a culture that's just incredibly on the rise. Yeah, so I really enjoyed it. It was HBO just,
yeah,
really knows what they're doing. I've got to say, they're whoever is in charge of the theme music department, they're literally killing, yeah, it. Between that and True Detective,
yeah. Well, you know, I never thought the Eels would be part of my life.
I know.
And yeah, they picked a winner for that.
Yeah, they did. And the theatrics of like the intro scenes, like, it's just, we're watching that show and I'm just like, this is bananas, yeah, how crazy this is. So, kind of, you know, it's only 6 episodes.
Yeah. If you're still listening.
Yeah.
Sorry. If you haven't seen it.
It's worth seeing though.
Yeah. Check it out.
Yeah.
Our descriptions will cut it out at the knees.
Quickly, because you are, before we get out of here, because you're an aficionado of true crime, recommendations?
Yeah. The classic true crime, I think the best piece of true crime is Helter Skelter by, mm-hmm, Vincent Bugliosi. He was the prosecuting attorney for the Manson family murders. A truly, truly insane story.
Really?
The murders themselves were outlandish, but the trial and everything, you know, like Charles Manson is still a person that is, yeah, on the earth. So yeah, check that out. If you're a stat head, Bill James,
really,
wrote a book called Popular Crime. So Bill James, you know, father of sabermetrics,
yes,
baseball statistics, is a true crime fanatic.
So you guys are just going to be best friends.
So he, in that book, Popular Crime, he says he thinks he's read over 1,000 pieces of true crime.
Really?
And he, because he's Bill James, comes up with a system to rank these true crimes. So they have all of these categories. Was it money? Were they celebrities? Was it a sex crime? Was it, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And then in that, so he has those abbreviations. Then he gives a number from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, 1 being the lowest. So like OJ Simpson was, the OJ Simpson trial was really high because it, you know, a crime between a man and a wife, a high profile person, you know, high news involvement. So he ranks all of these crimes.
Yeah.
Really, really fascinating, a little dry,
sure,
but really good.
It's still statistics to a degree.
And, the Jinx sort of, the thing that really kicked off my interest in true crime many years ago was, the HBO documentary Paradise Lost.
Yep.
And now there's now 3 parts to that, that tells the story of, the killing of 3 young boys in, West Memphis, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And the teenagers who were found guilty of their murder under very, you know, flimsy details. Really hard to watch, but that, you know, I think I was 19 or 20 years old when I saw that. It was soundtracked by Metallica and really effective, really devastating documentaries. And it's just interesting to see now, you know, 15 years later.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call The Jinx or Serial devastating.
Right.
You know, we've come to a different point with these stories now where we're, you know, they're just, we're absorbing them differently and they're ending differently. And
yeah, well, that's my question too. And I'm going to watch Paradise Lost. Are there more theatrics to it now? Is that what does it?
I think so. I think it's just the immediacy of which we can process this.
Okay.
As a culture, the timeline of Paradise Lost was, I saw the documentary, I went to work the next day, and I told people about it, and they were like, "Oh, that's weird."
Yeah.
And they didn't know. And then I found one guy who had seen like 10 minutes of it, and we talked about this scene. And then it really just like laid dormant for years.
Yeah.
Because the internet wasn't the internet then. Yeah. There wasn't a Reddit thread, you know, subreddit that, you know, to it. And then as years and years grew, as the internet grew, the cause of the three men who were found guilty grew.
Yeah.
They had a lot of celebrities help them out and raise money for appeals and things like that. And now I think like when a story like Serial or like The Jinx drops into the culture from nowhere.
Yeah.
Hey, this thing is coming. Here it is. Within 24 hours, the world is telling the story at a more robust way than the creator of the producer or the director could ever hope to tell it. Because now instead of like a team of like 10 people working on this, now there's a team of 10,000 or 100,000.
Well, I mean, Serial, I knew about Serial after episode 2.
Yeah.
You know?
And yeah, like the subreddit, I'm sure there's probably a Robert Durst.
Well, but here's the other subreddit thing too, that we're probably also not hitting on, which is television a la carte podcasts, listening and watching things when you want to. Right.
Yeah.
So Paradise Lost comes on HBO. What are the odds of you like being able to see that if you miss it, or if you come in at a certain point? Right. And I think because I found out about Serial after 2 episodes, right? Well, I just subscribe to the podcast and I catch up while I'm driving to work or whatever. You know, I find out about Jinx a couple episodes in. Okay, let's binge watch a couple episodes. Like, that's just the environment we live in now.
Yep.
And it's also the way that we, you know, I get all of my information. I mean, I read the paper in the morning, right? Locally, mostly sports section. But I get most of my world news from Twitter, you know? And it's like a binge of texts, or it's a binge of tweets that jump out because they're curated to my likes. And so, you know, the more people always say we're getting dumber because of technology, I think we're getting more astute. You know, we're becoming more, it's an easier way for us to take in information because of the environment around us, because technology's made it easier.
Yeah, I think because of that, it's easier to understand something that was maybe a bit obscure, or whatever, like, because it is the message of it. I don't think it's right to say that it's being simplified, but it's being distilled constantly.
Distilled's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you could probably craft a 140 character tweet.
Yeah.
That would inspire somebody to watch The Jinx or listen to Serial.
Yeah.
And, you know, just using simple language.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, 15 years ago with Paradise Lost, like, I just had to happen to be watching HBO at that moment and being caught like, oh, that's a Metallica song.
Yeah.
What's this?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's it. That's what got its hooks in you.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wow, this is unbelievable.
Yeah. This is something that happened to people who are my age.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrifying. Yeah. So that's, that I think about wraps it up.
Yeah.
Great. Just an amazing series. Again, HBO continues to do just the best work. But yeah, I think that, you know, I think that when Serial comes back next season, maybe we'll do a couple.
Yeah. We'll dig into that.
Yeah. And depending on how good it is,
and
I'll judge openly.
We'll be back soon with more or less serious stuff.
Well, there's always going to be some, I mean, sports dominates a lot of our conversations, but you know, we are pretty fully immersed in all pop culture. So yeah, I mean, when something, you know, catches our interests,
we'll tell you guys about it.
It'll be on the Most Basic Cable. Cool. All right, man. We will see you guys, or talk to you guys soon.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.